Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. From many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's May the 9th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I had hoped to discuss the difference between actual solutions to white genocide in contrast to the silliness of the movement, but something else came up. I still plan on covering that topic, but first I need to talk about the aftermath of the Boston-baked bombs. Regardless of whether or not the Boston attack was a false flag, one aspect of the response is alarming. As background, throughout the past decades, the movement and the right wing in general have consistently made accurate predictions about exactly which awful things will happen if some set of conditions, be they racial, economic, or otherwise, aren't reversed. Without fail, these predictions come true, and things are far worse for the white race than they were before. One of our people, allowing for different meanings of our people, will, at some point in this process, remark that either they won't do that, or, it can't get this bad. And obviously, this person is the sort which later says, I never thought things would get this bad. Obviously, this is a clever justification for failing to take action. I've spoken before on what happens to a person's psyche when they refuse to participate in the Northwest Imperative, and this sort of I never thought statement is a much more generic version of such a dodge. I figure some of you are starting to get a little sick of me relating my discussions to Northwest migration. I consider the problem to lie with you, not me, but since I'm a nice, positive sort of guy, I'll lay off for the time being. Instead, I'll focus on what's wrong with the person who makes I never thought remarks. These people operate on a particular mindset which doesn't usually evolve with time. After all, they've been around for at least as long as the racial struggle. The comment I never thought indicates a past tense opinion, which means at some point, they were instead saying something along the lines of, this is never going to happen, or perhaps, they're not going to do that, or even, I have rights and no one can take them away. We all know how well that one ends up working out. To be more clear, these people actively engage in the fantasy that bad things can't happen. This must be the case, since later, the bad things happened, just as everyone knew they would, so that the inactive person could then say, I never thought this would happen. We see this most commonly during watershed moments in our race's history, wherein the Union won the Civil War, Germany lost both world wars, racial integration is forced on our populations, massive immigration is used to displace the white peoples of the world, absurd taxes are levied against productive white people, certain of our firearm rights are infringed, and a nigger is elected president. Twice. The astute listener will notice I left out things like Waco and Ruby Ridge. Those incidents are still so muddled in the public's mind that they're not exactly on point. At each and every one of these moments, an honest, objective white nationalist could have and should have concluded the movement's options for success were dwindling. For whatever reason, the vast majority of white nationalists weren't willing to accept what was coming and what they really needed to do about it. In most ways, they still aren't, and that's just piss poor. Mr. Covington has repeated many times that merely naming the problem and discussing it doesn't actually solve it. On some level, the mentality of the movement has been just the opposite. They said how bad things can't get, so they obviously can't get that bad, right? Wrong. Dead wrong. At best, this sort of denial of reality, be it pre- or post-event, is nothing more than the usual begging other people to do a job these whiners won't. It's a cry to the mythical man on a white horse to save them. At this late point, anyone repeating the phrase, "I never thought it would get this bad," before they saunter off to read more bad news on the internet is nothing but a man-like damsel in distress. Guys, that's got to change. I don't know how else to put it, but it has to. I've tried over and over to spark some sort of urgency about migration, but that really could be outside the realm of possibility for most of you. It seems like you're all still hooked on the "how bad is it going to get" chatter. I'm willing to briefly accept that and try to go a little slower. We've just had another of these milestones where our race as a whole has to make a choice about whether or not it's going to accept reality. At most, this sort of thing ought to happen to a person no more than once. But a refusal to acknowledge this causes each white nationalist to repeat the pattern until they choose to break out of it and actually face the world. Radio Free Northwest has pointed out one of the traits of a national socialist, though it's something we all ought to do regardless of our political orientation, is to deal with the world as it is rather than as we would have it. I can't go any faster on this point since I've said I won't, though I'd love to jump right to migration. I'll need to save the truly practical application for a couple of talks later after I've dealt with analysis of possible solutions. What I'll have to do in the meantime is point out how all this relates to the response to Boston by law enforcement. This is the watershed moment I've been concerned with. But why? Why care what went on in a city an entire continent away from me? As it turns out, we've got a real problem on our hands, and it's something easily predicted by anyone not caught in the it-can't-get-that-bad rut. We've all seen the pictures of all sorts of military and law enforcement action in Boston on the internet. Most of you are rightly disgusted by the general situation, but I'm talking about something very specific. We've all heard from patriotards, many of whom wrongly consider themselves our comrades, that the military and police have taken oaths to uphold the Constitution of America, and they're not going to follow orders to consider Americans hostile. They won't do bad things to us. Surely it won't get that bad, right? Wrong again, morons. Some of the pictures seen by everyone in the world show us these so-called patriots, who surely won't hurt us, were willing to point their rifles at people inside their homes. These people pose no threat whatsoever. There's one picture in particular which shows a soldier in a combat vehicle pointing a rifle at someone in a house which wasn't even being searched. There are two things which are most important about this specific problem. First, this is a clear violation of the prediction that they won't do that to us. And second, it was totally predictable. After all, every right-wing nightmare has come true, particularly those which concern racial problems and government abuse. Anyone not caught in the rut of "it can't get that bad" could easily have pointed out, as has been suggested by the party, that it certainly can get that bad. And now it has. The core issue here is the mentality that keeps our people from dealing with reality as is. I won't spend too much longer on this point, since the logic these sad sacks use eludes me. But I must reiterate the more important aspect of what's going on. We just had a critical decision-making moment in our country's history. I'm sure there are plenty of examples of American military and law enforcement abusing the population, but the Boston incident is much more clear-cut and well-known. So what are you going to do about it? Every time we experience one of these fight-or-flight moments, not only do we fail to act correctly in response, but years later, we pretend as if we would act differently given the chance. When the next critical juncture rolls around, we fail all over again. This fallacy is very aptly named, "The Northwest is wrong, so let's stand and fight." The ultimate example of this self-deception is the idea that a neo-Confederacy has a shot at forming. Demographics alone prevent this, yet I'm badgered with pledges from these pretenders that should the South fall, they'll be right up here in the Northwest. Migration issues aside, this demonstrates we're dealing with people who simply can't or won't handle current events reasonably. Doing so would require admitting we passed the time for standing and fighting long ago. We now know the enemy is out for us in a very bad and very real way. To be more precise, we've known for quite some time, but now it's undeniable even by the most useless and inactive among us. So what are we going to do about it? Well, I know what I'm going to do about it. So what are you going to do about it? No, really, I actually want to know. This is about as much as we can take, short of someone being seriously hurt or killed in an extremely public fashion. In the past, these things have happened and in fact people have been killed, but it's not exactly common knowledge as far as the public at large is concerned. The Boston mess was more or less a public affair, and what went on isn't even in question. That's why it's our latest watershed moment. The public is as informed about it as we are. Seriously, guys, what are you going to do about it?
I let Andy kick it off this week because his comments are a good lead into a topic we all need to talk about, which a lot of you are going to find very depressing, including myself. But it's something we need to get our arms around because I'm afraid that there's a good chance that this is something we're actually going to have to deal with. Because more so than our usual run of wild speculation, this has a good chance of actually happening. Now, once again, I'm very seriously circumscribed as to what I can say here because of all the nasty neighbors listening over the fence who don't need to hear this. Yet, once again, I have to speak to you all for the record and for the future because this is the only real way I have of making sure that I reach those of you who do need to hear it. So, yet again, I have to ask you to bear with certain necessary obscurities in my little talk this week and read between the lines. Now, those who know what I'm talking about will know what I'm talking about, if you get my drift. Okay, every week almost, I get on here and I rant and rave at you guys, telling you that you have to change your innermost character, that you have to transform your personality and your personal ethics and your emotional hardwiring until you are the kind of people that our great-grandparents would have recognized. That you have to revert to a more ancient racial genotype, that you have to become someone you are not, blah, 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 blah. Now, I know you've all heard it before if you've been listening to this show even a little. White people cannot establish the Northwest Republic in our present state of moral and spiritual decrepitude. Somehow or other, we have to exert the massive act of pure will which will be necessary to transform ourselves from within as individuals and as a people so that we can take the kind of direct physical action which is the only way in which change may be brought about in our world, every other avenue to change having been closed off. I have lived my entire life knowing that this great transmutation of our racial character has to be done, and most of it I've lived expecting it to happen at some point in the future. When I was 25 or so, back around 1978 at the time of Operation Skokie, I was certain that if through some freak I lived to the age of 60 in the year 2013, things would be very, very different. Of course, back in those days, I didn't actually expect to live this long. I used to tell people, only semi-jokingly, that I was sure glad I didn't have to worry about getting old. But if I did live this long, I quite honestly thought that either the revolution would have come about and we would have won, or else there would have occurred some kind of huge cataclysm that really did send us back to the frontier or post-apocalyptic Mad Max way of life. In any case, one way or the other, by 2013 the entire paradigm would have altered, and the white man would have been forced to change by circumstances because he couldn't survive otherwise. Now, back then, of course, us movement guys spent almost as much time as we do today discussing and debating and speculating as to how the great change would come, how the monster in Washington, D.C. would finally come crashing down without our having to actually do anything, of course. And how the iron heel would be lifted from our necks so that we could at long last do all those great, brave, and bloody deeds that we all swore we'd do so long as it didn't involve actually resisting a cop or a federal law enforcement officer. In other words, in those days we talked pretty much the same shit among ourselves that we talk today. Now, there is an old comrade of mine back in North Carolina whom I will call Brother Bill, an old Klansman who did great work for years. And he has been with me the longest of anybody since I got back from Rhodesia in 1976. In fact, I just spoke to him the other night. He's getting a bit long in the tooth now, but hell, so am I. Anyway, Brother Bill always poo-pooed the whole balloon going up theory. He said even back then that the balloon will never go up as such, not in any of the ways that we speculated on. Now, he argued that there will not be one big huge cataclysm of the kind that we've been dreaming of for two generations, that finally knocks Carter or Clinton or Jug Ears or Obama off their perch for us, without us ever having to participate in that process. Now, this comforting idea that we white nationalists cling to like a security blanket, that somehow or other the tyranny can be brought down by some unexpected accident or act of God, with no one, or at least none of us, ever having to confront the United States and its armed men and its prisons. Now, this is a fantasy, a pipe dream. The idea that there is some way for the white man to play the game without putting anything on the table is simply one of the many rationalizations that we've come up with down through the years for showing yellow. Our brother Bill used to tell us all flat out that what we were looking at in North America was a long, slow deterioration until the country resembles Brazil, with a very tiny, extremely wealthy, more or less white-ish minority, plus a small cadre of Jews actually ruling over a coffee-colored mass of billions of primates, running things from big air-conditioned tower blocks in a world of soylent green. Now, certainly, in this pessimistic outlook of Brother Bill, this world of the future would get just a little bit worse every year, and every year the Iron Heel would get just a little bit weaker, a little bit sicker, a little bit more incompetent and confused, a little more filled with niggers and affirmative action employees gumming up the works, but never to the point where it will do us any good, at least not in any foreseeable future in our lifetimes. Because always the police and the FBI and the prison guards will still be getting paid, even if only in inflated Federal Reserve notes. But enough to keep them swinging the clubs and pulling the triggers for Washington, D.C. and whatever dictator is in office at the moment. Now, the courts and the prisons and the social services will still be functioning and destroying white lives and white families. And white males would still be way too timid and frightened to pull down on the muscle men with the badges. Now, Bill explained that this slow deterioration was what would happen because the fact is that this country is just too damned big, way too rich, too damned populated with creative and positive and hard-working white people who have bought into the Pat Boone red, white, and blue horse shit because it's all they have in their lives to keep themselves sane and going on, since they will never be allowed to hear any alternative worldview fairly represented. Now, these dumbass white people, while worshipping the very evil that is destroying them in their world, will keep the goddamn monster in Washington, D.C. going and going and going like a rapidly aging and falling apart Energizer bunny, until it's just a few crumbled bits and pieces lying on the ground. But even then, the bits and the pieces will still be twitching. Our brother Bill always understood something that it takes a lot of people, even me, some time to wrap our minds around. And that is the true problem is not the Jew. It's not the nigger. It's not the wetback. It's not the faggot. It's not the shit-headed liberal. The problem is the dumbass white who waves that red, white, and blue Masonic dish rag and who is so blind, bird-brained, stupid as to worship the very monster that is sucking his blood and killing him, like that monster in the Stephen King movie It that hides behind a clown suit. And so far, it looks like Brother Bill has been entirely correct. There have been some serious bumps along the way, true, but the fact is that the balloon has not gone up. Right now, it doesn't look like it ever will. Okay, I have already stated that in view of the events of the past 5 years, I'm willing to amend my opinions on that possibility. Now, I can, in fact, foresee several things that might indeed cause the balloon to go up, if the system's containment protocols fail. Now, the first is a Jewish attack on Iran that cuts off one-third of the Western world's imported petroleum. I've pointed out before, that just seems to have totally disappeared off the radar. It looks at this point like the containment protocols are working there and that somebody has talked Benjamin Netanyahu down off the ledge. Now, another is the collapse of the American monetary system due to Obama and Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve going berserk, printing monopoly money, and causing hyperinflation or some other crisis, which means that the muscle men, the gun hands, and the black body armor are no longer getting paid, and accordingly no longer protecting the dictatorship and its servants from the consequences of their own behavior. Another thing that might happen is some kind of financial or computer glitch that crashes the EBT card system, so that on the first of the month you've got 100 million niggers, beaners, and new white members of the Democrats' permanent underclass completely without funds. Now, can this country really handle the kind of mass rioting on the part of 100 million people that would result? Or some kind of cyber crisis that would take out the whole financial card system so that nobody's plastic works anymore, and you have to have actual money in hand, which of course by that time wouldn't be worth anything anyway. Yeah, there's things that could happen, but like I said, in my opinion, all these things could happen, and they might, but the fact is that they haven't happened yet, because the people who run this society, mostly the dumbass white Pat Boonies and a few very clever Jews, have become expert at plugging holes in the dike. The story of America over the past 30 years is one long tale of crisis management, of government thinking 10 minutes ahead but fast on its feet. Now, the understood purpose of most government and law enforcement these days is to keep the lid on and cut any corner necessary to do so. Like alcoholics in a 12-step program, the people who actually rule the United States have become adept in taking it one day at a time. I mean, my God, look at California. I still don't understand how California continues to exist. At the rate they're borrowing money, they're going to be in debt until the sun explodes, but it just doesn't seem to have any effect. None of this crap seems to have any effect on the basic workings of this society. It's just like we're so big and so rich that it still just kind of rolls off our backs. Like water off a duck's back, only the trouble is, in this case, it's acid rain. The water is burning the duck's back and removing the feathers, but it's still rolling off, and that's a very tortured metaphor, so I won't continue with that. Anyway, here's what we need to start thinking about and anticipating, because it may well turn out to be this way. Now, what do we do if, in fact, there is no change whatsoever over the coming years? What do we do if things just continue to get a little bit worse and a little bit worse every year, but the gunmen in the black body armor and the judges and the prison guards keep on getting paid enough and in some form of spendable currency so that they remain at their posts? And the iron heel stays clamped down, so the only way that we have to bring about change is to actually confront them. Confront them with what? Suppose that great transformation of character, which I keep howling and pleading for you guys to carry out, doesn't take place. Suppose our wee little Northwest Front continues to grow, but slowly, so agonizingly slowly that it makes no difference. Suppose the media blackout remains clamped down tight, and we never ever go viral because the media simply will not let anyone know that we are here. That may well be the case, I can't be sure, but am I the only one who has noticed that the media feeding frenzy in which they were ripping Seattle ceramic artist Charles Kraft to pieces abruptly halted in its tracks once he appeared on Radio Free Northwest a few months ago? Because they couldn't continue to savage Charlie without inadvertently giving the Northwest Front an RFN public exposure? Looks like the ban on any publicity for the Northwest Front actually can trump and halt a media feeding frenzy. I just did a Google, and as near as I can tell, on March the 26th, somebody pulled the plug. Not a hostile peep about Charlie since then. Now, this week, we finally edged above 6,000 hits per week on the northwestfront.org website. As internet goes, that's chicken feed. So, let's say that nothing changes. Let's assume for the sake of argument that I myself survive my medical problems through luck and the regime decides I'm not worth bothering to pull an Edgar Steele on, and that 10 years from now I turn 70 years old and I'm still sitting here yakking on this podcast once or twice a week because essentially nothing has changed, at least not to any degree that would do us any good, because you haven't changed. Because you have made no effort of will to grow stronger and purge your soul of timid fear. So the end result is that all of this just goes on and on and on, and 10 years from now, I'm still getting emails saying, "Dear Harold, I like your novels and I would like to migrate to the Northwest. Can you please send me some literature?" Now, in the meantime, this country will have been transformed into a one-party state run by liberal Democrats. President Hillary Clinton will be about to be succeeded by President Andrew Cuomo. The Republican Party and Fox News will probably have disbanded, and absolutely nothing will have been done about any of this, because we have remained too weak and timid and frightened to do so, and we have condemned our own people to death. That can't happen. We need to start working on a doable plan based on the worst-case scenario assumption that things will not change for the foreseeable future, that white people will not change, and that we will remain too weak and timid and frightened to do anything serious. We need to presume that the balloon will never go up, at least not in the sense we've been talking about for the past 40 years. But instead, there will be a long, slow, but steady deterioration, first into Brazil, and then in another 50, 60 years, into Soylent Green. This is a good way to segue back into my conspiratorial method lecture series. But before I do that, I think you guys probably need some cheering up. So here's the opening theme to a really great British TV series called Sharp's Rifles. It's about the swashbuckling adventures of a British officer in the Napoleonic Wars. The political correctness element is there, but it's minimal, and I highly recommend it.
Here's 40 shillings on the drum for those who volunteer to come to list and fight.
While you're pondering the point I made before the music break, i.e. what the hell do we do if nothing essentially changes at all and things simply get worse and worse, we've got Lord Lucan and Gretchen up next. Now, a word about Lord Lucan's piece. I am periodically accused of being both pro-Republican and pro-Muslim, neither of which is the case. The pro-Republican crap I generally get because I admit my bad habit of listening to Rush Limbaugh and pointing out that he does occasionally have a point or two, especially now that he's apparently been given permission by his handlers to talk about immigration and, to a lesser extent, about race itself, which is something he never did before. Now, the pro-Muslim accusation is largely because I won't sign off on what has become known down through the years as movement modernization, which is basically an attempt on the part of some very slick hebes to transmute all us evil racist fascist types into neoconservatives and booster the Israeli war effort, because we become all about Muslims, 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 and also these modernizers keep trying to sneak Jews and faggots into our movement through the back door, pardon the pun. The worst examples of this are the National Front in France with their Jewish elected officials, the BNP in Britain with their candidates proudly parading their racially mixed families, and, last but not least, the so-called English Defense League, which now has a gay, lesbian, and transgender unit. Enough said. Now, I admit, back in the day, I used to hope that there would be some way we could get some serious money off the Arabs so we could finance a serious movement. But with the general atmosphere of paranoia and hysteria all around these days, that's impossible. Even if a legitimate and tame Muslim regime like the Saudis or the Turks offered us financing, we couldn't touch a dime of it. Bad optics, as the liberals say. I do believe that, non-white or not, what has been done to these people by the Jews and the Americans is utterly unspeakable, and at the very least we can show them the respect for their dead children of not calling them ragheads and sand niggers and so on, but I know I'm in a minority here, so I won't push it. I also understand, very clearly, that our European comrades have a very different viewpoint on this than Americans. Because in their countries, especially in France and Britain and Sweden, Muslims are the racial problem, like Mexicans are here, only in some respects worse. I get that. So, just to show that I am not some kind of guru who demands absolute agreement with everything I say, here is the Honorable John Bingham, 7th Earl of Lucan, who has been lying doggo here in the Northwest for some time, but who does appear here on Radio Free Northwest.
Now, we in this movement consider Judaism to be the most evil religion because of what George Lincoln Rockwell has written about them in White Power. But there is a more evil religion by far than Judaism, Islam. In the name of Allah, the Muslims are killing Buddhists, Jews, Hindus, atheists, Sikhs, Zoroastrians, Baha'is, Marxists, even opposing Muslim sects such as the Shia or Sunni, as well as 100,000 Christians in 2012. And yes, they will even murder evolutionists in the name of Allah. As a Christian, if you think that communism is bad, whereby you will be sent to concentration camp for preaching the gospel, then compare that to Islam, where preaching the gospel will get you the death penalty. And if you are an evolutionist, you will also get the death penalty. Just because Muslims hate the Jews doesn't make them our allies. Islam has a world-conquering religious philosophy, and they intend to achieve world conquest by means of bullying and holy war. Now, there are five pillars to Islam. They are, 1, there is one God, Allah, and his prophet is Muhammad. Number 2, prayer, and a devout Muslim prays 5 times a day towards Mecca. 3, charity, and some of their charities raise money for holy war. 4, pilgrimage or Hajj. Number 5, holy war or jihad. Now, you'll notice that none of the five pillars of Islam require a Muslim to practice right action or righteousness. This means that even a criminal could become a devout Muslim. This should remind you of the Godfather. Now, the leader of the loony left is George Fox. He was a Quaker who stated that both Jews and Muslims can be converted to Christianity by means of the conduct and example of the Quakers or the Amish. Well, in his own time, the Royalists were not converted to Protestantism by the conduct and example of the Quaker religions. Freedom had to be won in England by defeating the Royalists on the battlefield. After winning the English Civil War, Oliver Cromwell wrote a constitution for England, in which he wrote, "The right of Protestants to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Now, the reason that conduct and example does not convert primitive people to Christianity is because primitive people do not think like that. Primitive people think like gorillas, and gorillas submit to the biggest bully. Now, you can substitute the word niggerdom if you want. If you allow the primitives to vote, they will vote for the biggest bully, and you can say goodbye to the Constitution and freedom. Now, the Irish and the Scotch were white people, and white people were converted to Christianity by the conduct and example of St. Patrick. White people are more evolved than gorillas, and that is why Christianity has converted the white race to Christianity. Consequently, so-called white people who continue to be Muslims, such as Albanians and Chechens, cannot be classified as evolved humans. Because they are accepting a gorilla religion, they need to be classified as gorillas. Now, where are the gorillas? They are in the wild or cage in a zoo. The same has happened to people who support and practice a gorilla religion. Therefore, no gorilla religions or non-white religions can be permitted in the Northwest Republic. Now, let us talk about the Prime Directive. Now, all of us Trekkies and evolutionists should be supporting the Prime Directive. The Prime Directive means the non-interference in other people's evolution. It means that you do not supply weapons to primitives. This directive was violated by the British government in that they supplied the Argentinians with bombs before the war for the Falkland Islands. Those bombs were used against the British Navy to sink British ships in that war. It would have been poetic justice if they had sank the entire British Navy in that war. Also in Tacoma, the Bullseye Gun Shop supplied the Bushmaster to a nigger who went to Washington, D.C. and proceeded to murder people in that town. Now, Negroes do not make firearms. The only arms they can make are spears and bows and arrows. And yes, the nigger in question was a Muslim. He was a Muslim vet. So as evolutionists and supporters of the Prime Directive, we do not waste our time and money trying to convert primitives to the Protestant form of government known as democracy or freedom. These forms of self-rule belong only to the more evolved races of mankind and do not belong to those races that are still in the gorilla stage of development. Now, what sort of intelligence does one have in order to believe that God would use violence to advance his religion? Because that is what Islam believes. If there is a God, would he not have an IQ of over 200? And therefore, would not such an intelligent God be able to find an intelligent and therefore non-violent means of advancing his religion? Clearly, the followers of backward religions such as Islam and Judaism require people of low IQ, and a God with an IQ of over 200 would choose people with a low IQ?
Comrades, tonight I've decided to talk about a book called Women in the Nazi East, which is by Elizabeth Harvey. Now, this is a study that deals, obviously, with German women that went east in the 30s and 40s, and they were involved in the Germanization of the East. Now, this project of Germanization was not totally unique to the Reich. It went on even in the 1850s and 60s in terms of Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Eastern territories that were always being disputed. But this concern with Germanization was always very appealing to middle-class German women who wanted to create a Volkisch feeling among German villages and were often sent east as teachers. And this happened with Protestant groups and student groups even before the 30s. But the Deutsche Maidenbund and the Women's Labor Service really took a very strong role in this. Part of it was personal ambition. There was a lot of room for innovation and leadership in the East, and sometimes even for jobs in research institutes. These women would go east, and often it was during their land year, and this was considered a very important service. They could go with or without training, and it was always funded by the Reich Education Ministry, even after the 1936 Hitler Youth Law, which shifted funding to the Reich's youth leadership in most cases, but not in the case of the Eastern Service. And Eastern Service actually became necessary for a place at the university. For the most part, this type of service really involved the most dedicated. The women that served in the East found many different circumstances when they went there. Some found villages that were full of very aware families, but others found communities that had been very immersed in the culture of Eastern Europe. But in any case, they tended to be given a lot of respect because of their education, and the settlers would really look to them for a lot of help and guidance. And women were considered prime candidates for this because they were considered to be good with children and families. They really got involved in explaining a lot of the political concepts. Now, in the beginning, the hope was that the schools in the East would become as good as schools in the Altreich, and they tried to have very high educational goals. But as the war went on, the priority became more and more to evangelize and propagandize Eastern families and children. So they would often include things like music and poetry in their lessons. Although the writer tries to play this down, a lot of the women that were involved in going east really enjoyed their stay. As the war went on, sometimes war widows would also go east, but the typical woman that went east was often single and unmarried and often relatively young, and often they really were wedded to their careers. It was rather difficult to get excused as a teacher. Marriage in itself was not a reason, and marriages did happen with some of the, they'd meet German men typically when they went east, because they really were not encouraged to fraternize with the native population, but sometimes they'd marry. Pregnancy, usually they'd work through their pregnancy, but then when they had the baby, they would go back to the Altreich. Now, if it was pregnancy without marriage, that, of course, could cause scandal, and so they were removed from their post because they had to serve as moral examples, and if they couldn't do that, they had to be removed from their post, at least temporarily. As the Germans moved east, there was a lot of trolling for people of Germanic descent or children that could be assimilated. They had to work with all kinds of conditions. They had to help children that were, for instance, in some cases, malnourished. And they were really quite faithful. They really stayed at their posts until the very end. They really lived very exemplary lives, and at times even, although this was not recommended, they became rather friendly with the natives. Oftentimes in places like Warthergau, they sometimes even became friendly with the Poles, and at times the Poles actually evacuated west with the Germans. You have to understand, in Poland, they're always trying to figure out which side they want to be on, the Russians or the Germans, because Poland has been so kind of overrun and sort of torn apart because of geography. This book was a study of the recollections of these women and the way they viewed their Eastern service. And you really have to do a lot of sifting in this book because it's critical. It's an academic study. But critical as this author tries to be, you'll find it to be an informative and an interesting book. I think these women were very, obviously very dedicated to their teaching careers, and I think that makes it quite an inspiring story. So I hope you enjoyed the review, and I'd like to make a list. I know some people have been asking me for lists of my favorite books, and I'd like to do that maybe next time. I'll talk about that. There are some that I particularly enjoyed, so I'll maybe make a summary of some of those later on. This one won't necessarily be on it because this is, well, for one thing, it's a library book and it was a slow read and I had to do a lot of sifting, but I found the careers of these women to be quite inspiring. So thank you very much for listening.
Okay, second music break. Now, it occurs to me that I got a question a while back about Lord Lucan's intro theme music. That is probably the most famous of all British marches. It's called the Grenadier Guards March, and this is a much better version of it from the movie Barry Lyndon, which is another great flick I recommend you see if you can order it from Netflix or wherever. In the movie, they play this as the Redcoats are marching across the field at the Battle of Fontenoy and getting blown away by muskets and grape shots, stiff upper lips and all. Okay, it's time to consider something I'm sure none of us want to think about. Suppose the balloon never does go up. Suppose there is no cataclysm. Suppose the world restrains the mad dogs in Tel Aviv and quietly accepts and learns to live with a nuclear Iran. And suppose it turns out that the Persians really do want the nuclear reactors for nothing except generating electric power, so Israel stays in place and there is no upset in the Middle East that risks bringing the whole house of cards down. Suppose Paul Krugman and George Soros are able to find some way for the dictatorship to keep on spending more money than it takes in indefinitely. Maybe the perpetual quantitative easing, wherein the regime prints money to pay off its previous debts and then prints more and borrows that, and nobody calls them on it because they're afraid Obama or Hillary will send the bombers. Now, I'm not joking. As near as I can figure, that's what Jewish economics guru Paul Krugman is advocating in the media. Suppose the next 10 or 20 years are just a repeat of the last 50. Suppose this wretched American system continues to drag itself onward year after year with no change. I suppose the long downward slide just keeps on sliding and sliding and sliding and never slips over the edge into the abyss. Suppose the police and the FBI and the prison guards continue to be paid in some kind of money that they can actually spend. Now, maybe the dictatorship will set up a whole series of special stores and shops that sell a decent variety of food and toys at an affordable price for muscle men and their families, kind of like the military PX system. Now, that's how Stalin did it in the Soviet Union. He had special stores that only took hard currency or else special vouchers from privileged Communist Party bigwigs. There are already a lot of special federal employee perks like full coverage medical insurance, which are not available to the rest of us peons. I suppose the dictatorship becomes more adept at using such things to bribe the seething, soylent green population into remaining quiet. Well, more or less quiet. Anyway, suppose the muscle men do stay at their posts and continue to keep the Democrats in power with their hired muscle. Oh, there'll be some riots every now and then when the EBT cards are late, but still, let's say that the government is able to suppress them and stay in the saddle. Suppose that 10 or 20 years from now, the only way that we can ever bring about change in this country continues to be confronting the United States and its armed men. And so, of course, we never do so because we have been unwilling to change our own characters and become men again. So we keep on sitting here behind our computers, waiting for Harold Covington to finally pull the magic beans out of his pocket, and all of a sudden we're many years down the road and you haven't seen Magic Bean 1. Now that's not going to happen, by the way. Freedom Sons is pretty much the last of my magic beans. Whatever we do from now on is going to have to be done with what we've got now. Every year, things will be a little bit worse, a little bit more miserable, a little bit more corrupt, a little bit tighter in the budget and the pocketbook, a little bit more impoverished. Every year, unemployment will be a little bit higher, but nobody will notice because the true figures will always be fudged by the dictatorship. The talking heads will tell us that this is the new normal. The government will take up the slack with food stamps and EBT cards and Obama phones and eventually find some way to pay for flat-screen TVs and basic cable for the underclass that keeps voting the Democratic Party into power. Every year, more white people will die in poverty from non-white crime or from lack of medical care. Mostly, they'll be older white people who still retain some memory of how things used to be. And so that heritage, that folk memory, will be lost, and will be left, eventually, only with Beavis and Butthead. Every year, fewer books will be read, and every year, effective literacy among white kids will slide a bit more, until in 20 years' time, for all practical purposes, there will be no one able to read anymore. And so my Northwest novels and most of our racial literature and propaganda from times past will be useless. Perhaps the NF will be able to redo all of our material into internet media, which involves showing white kids pictures instead of trying to get them to read a block of text. But with only a few thousand hits per week, it won't matter if our sites are even still online and they haven't been pulled down under some stupid internet kill switch law or whatever. The media stranglehold on what the white dumbasses are allowed to know will continue, and the media blackout on the Northwest Front will continue to be clamped down tight. By the next presidential election in 2016, we might actually have reached 10,000 hits per week at the rate we're going now. Maybe 10,000 hits a week, unless somebody decides to shut us down, and all of a sudden I'm arrested for trying to hire a hitman to kill Khloe Kardashian or some such lunacy. I'm sure at some point something of the kind will come up for discussion in whatever cubicle deep in the bowels of the J. Edgar Hoover building is responsible for monitoring Radio Free Northwest. So, if all of this turns out to be the case, how do we roll? Now, I've said this before, and I've never been able to get any traction on it because it's something we really, really don't want to hear. Especially those of us who've been involved in this thing of ours for many years and who are on the edge of burning out. And yeah, I get that happens. I myself seem to have an unlimited capacity for beating my head against a wall. but not everybody's like that, and I understand. Assuming the absence of a catastrophic event, we're going to have to spend the next generation doing what we should have begun doing in 1954, the year of Brown versus Board Education, when the agenda of racial genocide on the part of the United States government became so clear that no one with two brain cells to rub together could miss it. We're going to have to do what we've been spasmodically trying to do in many ways since then. But this time, we're going to have to do it right. We're going to have to build up and lay down the kind of basic political, demographic, logistic, financial, and political infrastructure that we should have started working on in the 1950s. Now, let me spell this out. We are going to have to start over from scratch because nothing that we have been doing for the past 60 years has worked worth a damn. Now, that's what I myself have been trying to do since November the 5th, 2008, the day after Black Tuesday. It's been 4.5 years now, and I haven't accomplished anywhere near what I should have done. What can I tell you? Neither I nor anyone else has any magic beans hidden away. There is some physical real-world activity in the NF, so we've managed to get off the internet a little bit, but the story of everything that we do is the same. It's just happening too damned slow. Now, we may have just broken 6,000 hits per week on our website, but it's taken us almost 4 years to do it. In a way, we damn well better hope that the balloon doesn't go up anytime soon, because we're not ready. No one is. So, how do we proceed in the event of no balloon and nothing but more of the same long, slow decline into Brazil and from Brazil into Soylent Green? Because I think that's what we're going to have to assume is going to happen, and we have to proceed on that basis. Now, a balloon finally going up would be nice, but we can't count on it. This sinking ship has simply righted itself too many times. A little bit lower in the water every time, to be sure, but by the time it finally sinks beneath the waves for the last time, none of us may be here to see it. Now, assuming this to be what the future holds, there are three things that the Northwest Front is going to have to concentrate on over the next few years. First, last, foremost, overriding everything else, all of you people listening to this have to stop fiddle-farting around and come here to the Northwest, where you're supposed to be. Now, right now, what we need to concentrate on more than anything else is building small communities throughout the homeland, communities of white nationalists, gainfully employed and fully functional in society, white nationalists who live within half an hour's drive of one another and who interact with one another on a face-to-face basis, regularly. Last week, Rodney Martin asked me how we get white people off the internet. That's how. We just do it. You pack your computer away in a box, and you put it in the moving van or the U-Haul trailer, and you bring it here to the Northwest, within half an hour's drive of many other white nationalists, who will actually come by your house and help you set it up, where you will talk to them without using emails or chat rooms or other electronic media that can be harvested and stored away in those caverns in West Virginia where the FBI keeps their archives and databases. That's how we do it. We fight high-tech with low-tech. We beat the enemy's high-tech surveillance state through the use of low-tech, specifically a large truck or a trailer. Simple. These Northwest nationalist communities and the rudimentary support systems they provide will serve as the base for the second major activity of the Northwest Front, the beginning of the education and conversion to the independence ideal of the local white people who already live here. Now, a lot of you guys down through the years keep moaning at me, demanding to know why I don't immediately convert all the local white people and set up the support system, the picnic tables and the cakes and ale, so you guys can just saunter in from outside the homeland. I have never been quite sure as to exactly how I'm supposed to do this. Probably has something to do with those magic beans you guys seem to think I'm hiding in my pocket. I think some of you see me standing on a street corner passing out Northwest tracts like those little Christian comic books you find in bus stations and on park benches. And I swear to God, I think some of you really do have some kind of inner vision of me standing on a picnic table in a public park wearing a little cape and flourishing my saber aloft while I incite the mob to storm the Bastille with their pitchforks and torches. Now, that was a very dramatic episode in our history, true, but my name isn't Camille Desmoulins, and the year is not 1789. Political work among the local people, the woodchucks, has to begin soon, but it has to be done right, and it has to be done with some kind of support system in place so that the Northwest Front's activists don't end up defunctionalized and disabled when they slip up or when the media finds them. And our local organizers will make slips, and the media will find them eventually. Now, we've never really tried this revolution thing before, you know, not since 1861, anyway. We don't really know how to go about it, and I can't teach you just from reading books and babbling on this podcast. So, our local missionaries to the Muggles are going to need a support system and guidance from a general headquarters propaganda staff and a national organizer, none of which we have at the moment. I say again, the first step towards everything we need is for you to come here. Form those communities all throughout the Pacific Northwest and give us some boots on the ground to work with. Now, we have some people here in the homeland who are already functioning all on their own as lone wolves, isolated in small Northwest towns. Guys who cannot risk defunctionalization because they're all alone without a support system, and if they slip and fall, they're working without a net and they're going to go splat. We need to get them some backup. You need to start packing that moving van. Now, the third thing that the NF must do during this coming period of long, slow American decline, sans the balloon going up, which looks to be what might happen, is to create an alternate media which will allow us to communicate with our own people in significant numbers, bypassing the establishment media's blackout. Now, creating these alternate information sources is one of the few things our wee little movement has done, even halfway approaching right over the past couple of decades, although not nearly well enough, and thanks largely to the Internet. Yes, a lot of our alternate media will have to be internet and computer-based until things start happening that get us on the cable news networks, whether the power structure wants us there or not. I'm sorry, guys. As much as I curse and rail at the internet and the poisonous, paralyzing effect it has on our people's minds, there doesn't seem to be any way around it. I tell our people to make sure that they hang on to those dusty, cobwebbed old mimeograph machines in our garages because we may need them again someday. But, like the Mad Max scenario, nobody really wants to go back to those days. We've gotten too spoiled. Hell, just for Auld Lang Syne, when I was writing Freedom's Sons, I tried to do a couple of chapters longhand on the first draft, and I could never scrawl out more than 5 or 6 pages before I had to get back on the computer. I'd become so spoiled and used to writing with the speed of lightning and instantly correcting errors. Now, we've actually made a passable start. We have the 5 Northwest novels as a kind of baseline, a basic ideological primer. Even though they do depend on an increasingly shaky white literacy. But given literacy, with such things as PDF copies and Kindle readers, that means that if the demand ever did suddenly ratchet up, we could distribute hundreds of thousands of copies damn near for free to people who want to read them. I think one of the reasons the Kikes have never made any moves to suppress my books is that they know that they can't anymore. The days when the ADL could silence a book or an author are long gone. All the censors can do is impose a blackout to make sure that no one knows the suppressed book even exists, which, of course, is what they're doing to us. But we're increasing our YouTube capabilities, and I just realized I've been babbling for quite a while now, so it's time for a music break. This is Grandpa Jones, for no other reason than the fact that I like him.
There's a big holler tree down the road here from me, where you lay down a dollar or two. When you go round the bend and when you come back again, there's a jug full of good old Mountain Dew. Oh, they call it that old Mountain Dew. And them that refuse it are few. I'll shut up my mug if you fill up my jug with some good old Mountain Dew. Now, my Uncle Nort, he's sawed off and short. He measures about 4'2". But he thinks he's a giant when you give him a pint of that good old Mountain Dew. Well, my old Aunt June bought some brand new perfume. It had such a sweet smelling peel. But to her surprise, bet you had a deadline. It's nothing but good old mountain. Yummy dum, yummy dummy dum. Well, the preacher rode by with his head heisted high, said his wife had been down with the flu. And he thought that I ought just to sell him a quart of that good old Mountain Dew. Well, my brother Bill's got a steal on the hill where he runs off a gallon or two. The buzzards in the sky get so drunk they can't fly from smelling that good old Mountain Dew. Oh, they call it that old Mountain Dew. And them that refuse it are few. I'll shed up my mug if you fill up my jug with some good old Mountain Dew.
I've just replayed what I've done so far, and as has been the case a lot recently, it isn't really very satisfactory because I'm being too obscure and I can't really say what the hell I mean. But there are people listening to this podcast who seek to do harm, and so neither can I telegraph our plans and strategy to these people. So, absent some kind of super colossal game-changing event, and presuming that this whole dismal show just drags on and on with no end in sight until it finally does come to an end, sometime when we're all in our 80s and 90s, and we get dragged out of our little houses or our nursing homes and killed and eaten by starving non-whites. Anyway, until that day, those three things are what the Northwest Front needs to concentrate on. Migrate, migrate, migrate. Convert the locals once you people finally get your asses up here and form the first activity teams, and all the while create an alternate media to spread our message, especially here in the Northwest. Well, that ought to keep us going for a while. Now, one last comment before I sign off. One of the things I didn't mention before this is something that should be obvious. In order to do all of the above, we are going to have to raise money. A lot of money. No, this isn't a fund appeal. In point of fact, I didn't even send out a spring fund appeal this year because we're doing all right for the time being, meeting all our bills. And I want to save that fund appeal for when we have a special project, probably the actual book form publication of Freedom Sons. But as time rolls on and we continue to struggle like somebody sinking in quicksand just to get 100 or so more hits every week and to keep the Northwest Observer coming out on time, there will be times when I have to pass the hat and other times when I flat out have to scream for help. Now, when that happens, I will no doubt be accused of being a quote-unquote con man and quote-unquote living off the movement. In point of fact, no, I do not live off the racial cause. I live for it, which is a difference these goat-dancing idiots who level this accusation either don't get or don't want to get. Now that we've got that cleared up, I'm going to repeat something that I've said before, and I want you guys to wrap your minds around it. True power. The power to change the lives of individual people and the destiny of an entire people comes from one of two things, money or the gun. Some combination of both is best. That's how the Americans rule the world, with a gun in one hand and a fat roll of $100 bills in the other. We do not as yet have the courage or the competence to use the gun. But if somehow we can get hold of a little money, at a later date we may be able to bring together a kind of harmonic convergence of the kind that will give us what we seek. And I'll just leave it at that for the time being. Anyway, our time's up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Underban. Freedom.